I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, marking an exceptional break in the rough and tumble of American discourse and voting. What's new this time is fear, shock, and depression in an election aftermath. Frenchman writes an American friend on the Trump news, "It's a nightmare." American writes back, "It's worse than a nightmare. It's our reality. It's part of the problem that millions of people who hated Donald Trump but never took him seriously now take him literally. Other millions liked him speculatively and now take him seriously, but not literally. A few, including Ralph Nader, Ron Suskind, Mark Blythe, and others in our conversations over the past 2 years, never liked Donald Trump at all. But they took him seriously and now have to speculate about his literal or maybe metaphorical or crowd-happy lines about that wall, or Muslims, or exporting stateless people. How does all that regroup and find its place again in the all-new, still jarring visions of a Trump era? We're taking soundings this hour, starting with the president-elect at his last rally, 1 a.m. on Election Day in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
We don't need Jay-Z or Beyonce. We don't need John Bon Jovi. We don't need Lady Gaga. All we need is great ideas to make America great again. That's all we need. That's all we need. I mean, we are doing well. These people, the world's most dishonest people, the media, they are not happy. No, no. They're not happy. They're saying, what's going on? We're going to have real change, not Obama change. Do you want America to be ruled by the corrupt political class? Or do you want America to be ruled by you, the people? That's what it is, by the people. The way it was supposed to have been for a long time. We've lost track.
Does he mean it? And not so much who's going to believe him in the evocation of one nation, but who's going to hold him to it? Reflective samplings of unfamiliar emotions are all we have tonight from people you may not have heard. Historians Mary Beard on the link to the late Roman Empire, and Eric Foner on patterns going back to slavery in our roots and in our politics. Also, Kathy Kramer in her home state on what's the matter with Wisconsin. Randall Kennedy, black activist lawyer out of the Thurgood Marshall School. And two foresighted people watchers, maybe the only two who can prove it, Ron Suskind and Nathan Robinson. Evening, gentlemen. Randy Kennedy, get us started. Who's going to hold Donald Trump to that rosy vision, the spirit of the White House, in the White House with Barack Obama today?
Well, I don't know who's going to hold him to that. Let me just say that at this moment, I feel terrible. For the first time in my life, I feel afraid at the prospect of an incoming president. I feel despair. I feel deeply disappointed in the American electorate putting into power a person who is so ostentatiously ignorant, a demagogue, a person who said so many things that should have been absolutely disqualifying. So at this moment, Chris, I'm profoundly shaken.
I'm wondering, as you speak, Randy, whether he knows what I think is clear, that they didn't vote for him as much as they have voted against Hillary Clinton, a deeply flawed candidate, and it's 30-some years of this establishment, this neoliberal logic, which has torn apart so much of this country. It's not pro-Trump to me. It's a vote against something deep.
That could be. But let's stipulate that that's true. Let's stipulate that it was a vote.
I wonder if he knows it too. But go ahead.
It's hard for me to understand I can't get into what he knows. But all I can say is, let's assume that the Clinton candidacy was flawed. It was, but in the face of the Trump menace, what the American electorate has done is put the country in grave jeopardy. This was an American tragedy this week, and there's just no sugarcoating it.
Ron Suskind, journalist, teacher, writer, father, master, I believe, of deep narratives. What happened?
Well, Chris, let's do the first big narrative. Donald Trump called the question on American democracy. He called the question, is democracy effective in redressing grievances of the citizenry? Clearly, Trump voters said no. Did they vote against or for? Well, they certainly voted against our system of self-governance as it now stands. It could be all manner of grievance, where they stand as to their identity, somewhere on the nexus of the big three, race, class, or gender. Take your pick. In fact, all three merged together in this moment. As to the narrative of Trump, well, ultimately, Trump is speaking a well-worn narrative, which we've seen across the centuries, millennia, of the rich man who walks in the valley. He is the rich man from the coastal Golden Towers who walks into the wide valley of the disenfranchised, puts on that red cap, Make America Great Again, and, well, some might say, impersonates kinship with them. But it is effective. When he says, I am your voice, they say, yeah, I'm buying that. And right now we are in a state of true dilemma as to what democracy is supposed to be able to do, which is harnessing informed consent in the Jeffersonian model, even by the gentleman farmer, even by the unwashed. They will pick their representative to run the one thing that's shared, which is the government of all people. Right now, to smash the current system, they've put in a man whose next moves are utterly unpredictable. I think virtually nothing he says in this campaign has sure applications to what is coming next. Because ultimately, he never was engaging in literal speech. Hillary Clinton engages in literal speech. My friend Randy Kennedy engages in literal speech. The words carry the supposed definitions as to their exposition. Trump never spoke that way. It was all symbolic speech, all coded, all hint, suggestion, inference of anger, and inference of not what I will do, but how I feel and how I feel what you feel.
So you're discounting both the threats and the promises. I want to go back to Randy, though. You're a congenital optimist, and I am too, but I don't want to sugarcoat anything. But I just want to push back on the general notion out there for a long time that the country that the last two times out elected Barack Hussein Obama has gone suddenly racist. Or racist in a new way. We know the roots, but what's different now, Randy?
Well, I mean, when Barack Obama was elected, it wasn't as if racism had gone away.
No.
I mean, the backlash began, well, before Barack Obama was elected president. It picked up steam after he became president. I will live out the rest of my life in backlash against Barack Obama. And there were a lot of things going on, gender things, class things. But on the racial front, one of the things going on was that a substantial part of the American electorate was left absolutely unhinged by the presence of a black family in the White House. Mm. That drove them absolutely crazy. And that is part of what led to Trump's victory. He tapped into it. Again, that's not the whole story. But the fact that it's even an appreciable part of the story is an indictment of our political culture.
And what about a black family being succeeded by a lady president?
Well, that was probably that probably was a step too far for obviously it was a step too far for our country.
Ron.
Oh, look, Trump was just a much better candidate at what he deigned rightly in a reality-based way was needed at this moment, which was change. Hillary Clinton never managed to represent change. And look, some of it's baked into the equation. She's been on the public stage for three decades. But the fact is, Trump knew change is what people will vote for. And right now, they're saying just blow the damn thing up. It's not working. Blow it up now. The rest is for later, for never. We'll figure that out then. Trump got that. And the fact is, he says nothing that's true. Virtually not a word he says is true. But he is utterly reality-based in summing up America at this moment.
Meaning what? Reality-based? Reality TV or reality-based community or fantasy or what?
No, reality-based is, look.
Make it up as you go along?
No, the reality-based is, you know, let's figure out what discernible reality is, what the facts say. Do we have any evidence anywhere? That's reality-based. Trump is in no way reality-based in the traditional model. Nothing he says is that at all. But he summed up the country in the way that the establishment on either coast did not, which is why he's the president.
Explain something. You know, it's a staple in legislative debates. You're asking us to buy a pig and a poke. We haven't seen what's there. How in the world did people choose somebody who they knew was an almost fathomless mystery?
Okay, here, look, the fact is many people in the country feel like they knew Donald Trump. Why? He'd been on the television for 13 years, prime time, in a well-produced offering of a show of reality. That's what he did. It's a show of reality, which politics, frankly, is too. They felt like they knew him from that show. And so when he jumped over into the political realm, it wasn't even a fair fight. The man is a practiced entertainer and known to people like they know their neighbor. And when he got up against politicians, he wiped out the stage time and again.
And yet, nothing but contradictions, Randy.
Well, I think what was just said, there was a lot of... it was very accurate, and all I can say is, what an indictment of our country. That's right. The country was swept up with this demagogue, this entertainer, and now this person has his hand on the nuclear button, or at least in a few weeks he will. What a frightening prospect that is.
Farce becomes tragedy.
We're going to talk more this hour about what in the world pushed people to that sort of feeling that there was nothing else to do. Coming up, the history, back to Rome, the British Empire, and the American founding that doesn't repeat itself, but as Mark Twain said, often rhymes. This is Open Source. Now what, as we were saying, and how did we get here? Because we long for the longer, wider view, we enlisted Eric Foner, giant among American historians of the South and slavery especially, and also famous teacher of young giants, too, at Columbia University in New York. I caught him in London this week to ask about that 2016 election map. You've all seen it, the vast acreage of Trump's red rural America, and the concentrated blue of Hillary's big cities, the coasts, and Chicago, an old and suggestive story.
The idea of the little guy against the elite is certainly a trope which goes way, way back in American political combat, going back to Andrew Jackson and, you know, people like that long, long ago. The irony, of course, is that the man who is riding the populist wave is a guy who prides himself on being a billionaire, that's part of his image, and yet claims to speak for the common man. But even that is not unprecedented. And probably the president of the 20th century who was most associated with working class Americans was Franklin D. Roosevelt, and you can't get more elite than him. Mm. But, you know, I think Trump, to his credit, so to speak, as a politician, saw the existence or discovered the existence of a deep cultural and economic discontent out there, which he parlayed into his victory.
What's the short history of this phenomenon? How far back do you have to go?
I think you have to go back to the 60s, the tremendous social changes that were unleashed in the 1960s by the Civil Rights Revolution, by the Feminist Revolution, by the Immigration Law of 65, which changed the whole nature of immigration, and a very strong resistance to many of those changes on the part of people who were more committed to traditional family values, as they're called, traditional community values, and also traditional racism, one has to say, and saw those changes as very disruptive to their lives. Then you add on to that the economic dislocations, which again have been going on for half a century. Deregulation under Reagan, deindustrialization under Reagan and Clinton, and then the financial crisis of 2008 and the aftermath, where a lot of people felt that the bankers got off scot-free and nothing was done to help people who lost their homes and their jobs and that kind of thing. So that's a pretty potent combination of discontent, which Trump seems to have managed to harness.
Add the wars, Vietnam, to Iraq, to Afghanistan, and the end of the Cold War.
Good point. The Iraq War, apart from being probably the worst mistake in American foreign policy history, it tore communities apart, and that also feeds to resentment against the so-called establishment, you know, which Trump was running against.
Does a historian see something happening that's happened before or not?
History never really repeats itself, exactly.
They say it rhymes.
Elements of this have certainly happened before. Hostility to immigration is a recurrent phenomenon in American history. We had the Know-Nothing Party of the 1850s. So the notion that immigrants are coming in, they're taking our jobs, they're lowering our wages, they're committing crime. The language that Trump used against Mexicans could have been lifted right out of the Know-Nothing newspapers of the 1850s, but about Irish, they're rapists, they're murderers, they're criminals, they're undercutting our jobs. Same rhetoric 150 years or so ago. So there were certainly precedents for that, and there was Nixon's Southern strategy, which was instrumental in appealing to white resentment against the gains of the civil rights movement, and that helped to swing the white South to the Republican Party. But, you know, what's new in a weird way about Trump, Trump trades also in celebrity, in sexuality, in kind of flamboyance. That's unprecedented, really, in American politics. You'd have to go over to Italy, maybe, and look at Berlusconi, the former Prime Minister of Italy, who also traded on sexual celebrity, as Trump does.
You're talking about continuums, but not exactly cycles. What's the difference?
There's neither cycles or continuums. There's just history moving forward that always is rooted in the past, but every situation is different also. That's our job as historians, try to explain it as best we can.
Speak about the future that the Democrats, the liberals, were offering to rural America. Essentially, move to the coast and learn JavaScript, become a software engineer.
Yeah, the Democratic Party didn't have much to offer to those communities. When Trump speaks to the establishment, in a certain sense, he's right, because that sort of neoliberalism idea that people are just factors of production and that the free flow of goods and capital and labor is better for everybody. People are not capital and people are not goods. You can pick up your factory and move it somewhere else, and that's fine, but people don't just pick up and move somewhere else because of economic hard times. They have communities, they have churches, they have families, and the disruption of these kinds of economic changes, which were promoted by both parties, by the what Trump would call the elite of both parties, He tapped into the deep resentments that those things have caused. And yes, neoliberalism of both parties didn't have an answer for the human toll that economic policies have wrought in the last, let's say, 30 years.
No cycles of history then, says Eric Foner, but age-old themes. Randy?
I think that what Eric Foner said is true. He delivered a critique of Trump, but he also delivered a critique of the Democratic Party.
Thank you.
And I think that a lot of that's true. Fine. It is still the case, however, that we have, coming into office, a person who on nationwide TV, in a debate, said that if he became president of the United States, one of the first things that he would try to do would be to lock up his political opponent. A red line was crossed there. My mouth flew open. It seems to me that millions of mouths should have flown open at that clear and egregious insult to the democratic ethos, which should, you know, which we should respect.
Respond to Eric Foner, Ron Suskind. Including, we've got to introduce the neoliberal elephant in the room.
Yeah, Trump played a brilliant modern calculation of us versus them. And the them was the technocratic neoliberal idea. There ain't no hope in it.
I want to go to Kathy Kramer in Stevens Point in Portage County, Wisconsin, the state that gave us the progressive Robert La Follette, the reactionary Joe McCarthy, the SNL comedian turned liberal senator Al Franken. Wisconsin, which chose Barack Obama over Mitt Romney 4 years ago and picked Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton this week. Kathy Kramer, native Wisconsin scholar, close listener. Welcome to Open Source. The clues to this Trump swing are all around you. What happened?
Well, I think a big thing that happened is, as other folks have said tonight, happened in the rural areas of our state. And I have been hearing for almost a decade now just a deep and pervasive resentment against the urban elite among folks in rural and small town Wisconsin. And Trump just very deftly tapped into it. You know, it was this sense that we're working so hard to make ends meet and we are not getting our fair share. We're not getting our fair share of power. We're not getting our fair share of public resources or wealth, and we're not getting our fair share of respect. And when Trump came along and said, you know what, you're right, and you're not getting what you deserve, and you are hardworking Americans, and it looks like what you're not getting is going to other people who are less deserving than you, and elect me, and I will make America great again.
Kathy Kramer, you sound sweet, reasonable, rational. do your voters sound that way?
Yeah, honestly. So I've been inviting myself into conversations in gas stations and diners and just asking people, what are your big concerns? And this is well before Trump was on the scene, right? And people would tell me about what they loved about their communities and what they missed about their communities, and the way they conveyed their resentment to me was often reasonable and kind.
Is it,
believe it or not,
between pick among nostalgia or xenophobia or racism or make America great again? What's the emotion here, and do you trust it?
Yeah. Boy, I'm not sure if I trust it, but the emotion is just sadness and loss, a sense, the world is leaving us behind. Mm-hmm. And I guess I trust it because it seems very genuine to me. I don't mean to leave out the racism or xenophobia part, because I mean that's part of the Trump package and you can't deny it.
Randy Kennedy.
The great historian Richard Hofstadter talked about status anxiety and the feeling of people dropping down and resentment. It's got a long lineage in American history, and I think that we're seeing it now. I think we're seeing it with respect to gender. I think we're seeing it with respect to race once again. People who at one point they might have been downtrodden, they might have been poor, they might have been subordinate in various ways, but doggone it, at least they were white. At least they were above, some people. Now these people turn on the television and they're seeing people of color being the big shots on television. They turn on the radio or the television and they see the first person who wants to be president of the United States on stage with Beyonce and Jay-Z. They see the first family of the United States. They feel left behind, and they are going to take it out. Your previous caller used the word resentment over and over and over again.
She's there, yeah.
And that is a key word here, and status anxiety is behind that resentment.
I want to go back to economics, too, and I want your thought, Kathy. But Amitav Ghosh, widely traveled novelist and, to me, a very interesting watcher, said to us a couple of weeks ago, the logic of the modern economic system, and Eric Foner just said it too, is poison for communities, whether it's in China that's sending whole generations of young people out of their villages, or India, or this country where, like, take a ticket, you know, call U-Haul, pal, and get to California somehow. What about it? These people, I think, were crying at the logic of that system.
Well, there's right.
Ron Susskind.
You know, resentment is at the core of it. Randy is right, but there's also a kind of economic calculation. Three quarters of the country hasn't had a raise in 40 years. They eventually woke up to that and said, I'm going to race against some guy in Jakarta or Singapore for $3 an hour. It's not going to work. The country and the coastlines are in a great updraft of the global economy. I'm left behind, and I'm not going to stand for it anymore.
Kathy,
that's
I want to hear about the commodification of people, you know, economic units, as Eric Foner was just saying.
Oh, well, people totally resist it, right? What they're asking for is respect. They're asking to be respected as human beings. And the idea that some folks in a think tank or a university, heaven forbid, right, are telling them that, well, really the solution is you just tool up and move to the cities and get a different occupation, that totally runs against the grain of who they think they are in the world, right? They value their communities, they value their families, just as Eric Foner said. And so people are so resistant to that idea.
Who was it was saying that President Obama and Jeff Immelt, you know, they talked about all those shovel-ready jobs that weren't shovel-ready after all, pal, right? Winks, nudges. And the comment was, if I had been an unemployed machinist in America and heard those guys talking that way, I'd have voted for Trump 5 years ago.
Oh, I think there's no doubt that that they saw hard reality and needed someone to give voice to it. I mean, this notion of what the Democratic Party was saying, I mean, my God, who supports tariffs to save jobs? It's a Democratic position. Trump just plucked that right off the tree. He just said, no one is representing a huge class of people. Yes, racism, misogyny, all those things he threw into the mix. But at the core of it is a hard reality-based judgment Trump made, owned, and leveraged, frankly, brilliantly, to become the president.
Kathy Kramer, you know, Eric Foner was also saying Donald Trump has no magic solution for any of these problems. What can he do when people are really worried about the robots coming over the hill and their jobs?
Right. Well, that's a great question. I mean, I'm so curious to see how he actually addresses the concerns of people in small towns in rural America, because they're significant issues, and there have been no great solutions so far, right? So it will be very fascinating to see what he does come up with.
I mean, it's part of the story, I think, that nobody knew whether Hillary was going to be for TPP in the end, which she helped draft, or against it, as she said on the campaign trail. That's significant, I think.
I was in a meeting at a big speech, and I had them raise their hand about 3 months ago. I said, give me one position Hillary Clinton's in favor for that bespeaks change. No one raised their hand, and it was mostly a progressive group. There's 500 people. That bespoke a problem. No vision, no real idea as to what would change by virtue of her becoming president, other than the first woman president, which, of course, is enormous. But it wasn't enough to inspire people, certainly not around her banner.
I invite everybody here to play Pick a Statistic, and maybe you should go first, Kathy, with the precinct that told you what the hell was going on.
Oh, gosh, I don't know the exact number, but I would say there's parts of the state in Wisconsin that are pretty rural, but are traditionally nevertheless voted Democratic, and when it was clear that those went Republican, I knew what was going on.
Here's my little statistic. College graduates voted 5-4 for Hillary. Not a big surprise. Non-college white people voted 2-1 for Donald Trump. For me, the Democratic moral is obvious. Find a way to give people an education and get them out from under big debt. Did we ever hear that on the trail? Randy?
Well, I mean, Bernie Sanders talked that talk, and then Hillary Clinton, to her credit, picked up on it. So, yeah.
Remind us, Kathy, why and how Bernie won Wisconsin in the primary.
Well, I think there's a lot of support in Wisconsin, just in our political culture, for people who are willing to stand up against the political establishment. I mean, it's come in different forms in our state. We've had La Follette, and we've also had McCarthy, right? And Bernie Sanders represented to a lot of people a very different kind of Democrat, and it was, he appealed to different people than Donald Trump did. But you know, he was something different and not your typical Democrat, which many people don't feel represented by.
Kathy Graham, what was your view of the flow of Bernie voters toward Trump or to Hillary? But I'm thinking especially about Trump, the insurgent vote.
Yeah, great question. I'm not sure I have a great answer for that one yet.
I just want can I give you kudos, Kathy? I've been a journalist for a long time, and you did real live reporting out there in Wisconsin that the Fourth Estate, the media, did not do. And let me throw something else out. There's a book that folks on the left have been embracing for years, What's the Matter with Kansas, by Tom Frank, brilliant guy. The fact is that was part of the problem. The idea from this position that the folks in Kansas don't know their own self-interest is something the folks in Kansas said, let me show you I know my self-interest, and I will vote it just like you do. I mean, that's exactly the kind of affront that angered them.
Randy,
well,
last word before the break?
I think it is the case sometimes that people do not know their best interest. They might say they do. They may be, you know, angry when you say that, you know, selling themselves short. But does that happen? Yes, it happens. All of American history shows that it happens.
Stand by, Randy Kennedy. Coming up, the really, really long view of empires, dynasties, language, and change with the historian of Rome, Mary Beard. This is Open Source. We're talking about you know what. Nathan Robinson joins us, enterprising, young, embarrassingly young editor of something called Current Affairs. In your inaugural issue, which knocked me out, Nathan, in March, you wrote, hello, Hillary Clinton is made to order for Donald Trump, and that here's how he will debate her. And you wrote it out of your head long before they came together in those debates. Credit for anticipating something. What do you make of the result?
Well, I think the result was pretty predictable and very disappointing. I mean, you could sort of see what we were heading for a little bit. I think a lot of the belief in Hillary Clinton's inevitability or electability was massively and woefully overstated, and that her weaknesses played to all of Trump's strengths, all these little pseudo mini scandals that his bombast sort of feeds on. And as we say, all the ability for him to whip up resentment against the elites. She's the ideal sort of elite for you to beat up on and use in that way. So I thought back during the primaries that she was a very dangerous person to pick simply because she was the perfect foil for all of what Donald Trump was going to use during the general election, and indeed he did, and it worked.
The theme was the vote against.
Yeah.
In short, would Bernie have beat Donald Trump?
I mean, it's impossible to know, right? I mean, we can only speculate. What I think is true is that it's plausible because there were certain things that Bernie Sanders had that made it look a little bit more favorable. I mean, obviously he's a Jewish socialist, so it was going to be a very hard sell no matter what. But the fact is that Hillary Clinton lost because she lost Rust Belt states, and Bernie had an appeal that was specifically calculated to play in those states.
I'm still trying to figure out how a young man with the Florida upbringing and a British accent could see what the rest of the world couldn't. I find it deeply, deeply, monumentally, maybe scandalously wrong that our media never told us. Hello?
Yeah, I think this is a story about the press. This is a story about bubbles and wishful thinking and about interpreting reality according to what you think reality ought to be rather than being willing to confront reality as it in fact is. And, you know, there was an echo chamber effect, and I bought into it myself. I started to believe that Trump couldn't win during the last few months of the election, and then I realized looking back that was entirely because I was being told it. And the people who were telling it to me, they didn't have any more more data than I did. But we all wanted it to be true, and so we believed it. But that has to end. I mean, there has to be a real rethink of how the press approaches politics.
Thank you. I confess, I unsubscribed to the New York Times today. Russell Baker, the giant of my era at the New York Times, said to me months and months ago, the New York Times doesn't know how to cover politics anymore. You're a young editor picking writers to tell us about our country. What's the key?
Well, I think that's a little bit unfair to the New York Times. The New York Times has
tries hard, but really.
It's still very important, I think. They do a lot. I mean, just because they're very well resourced and they do have journalists in a lot of places. And I mean, I actually think that this is a matter of how you interpret the New York Times rather than whether you read the New York Times. I think you have to learn to sort of pick up the subtle signals that are underlying the news rather than looking directly. I mean, one of the problems is their commentators are all very heavily poll and database, data journalism, explanatory journalism, instead of trying to assess undercurrents and trying to look for the news behind the news, taking things sort of at face value and being too credulous.
Kathy, you're now one of the great reporters on The Nation, but who else did you see out there listening hard?
Oh, well, Mike McCabe is a fellow Wisconsinite who is a person who's been very active in serving as a watchdog of campaign finance in the state, and has started up an organization called Blue Jean Nation. Hmm. And he has been doing a lot of listening in many parts of the state, and wrote a book recently of that name that says many of the things that I found too. So I'm not the only one, but it is striking
let's
that
credit
that's
Arlie Hochschild. We've credited
right, yeah. Yep.
Tom Frank, but Arlie Hochschild went from Berkeley, California, of all places, to sort of the oil patch in Louisiana and listened hard, really hard and empathetically. Not too forgivingly, I don't think. Ron, what's the problem? Nathan's saying it's in our media, and I that's very self-centered in a way, but I think it's true.
Well, you know, look, the reporters who go out there and speak with people without a preordained judgment, a paradigm they're hoping to fill, I think in a way are less and less. The newspapers don't have the horsepower, maybe they once did, to send a reporter out for months at a time, get away from New York, get away from Washington, just go find it out. And I'm not caring about what you find ahead of time. They're fewer and fewer. The punditocracy, which of course is wildly well-funded at this point, echoing in the echo chamber.
They have tenure, every one of them.
Enormously powerful in shaping
studying
opinion.
That wallpaper over and over again. I mean, how many times did we read New York Times columnists telling Donald Trump how to play politics?
Absolutely.
And
Willie Mays,
here's, actually, once upon a time on this program, Yo-Yo Ma was our guest, and a guy called in from the road and said, you know, I think if you held your bow a little differently, and I thought only on The Connection, which was our program then, would somebody call in and tell. But this was the New York Times columnist every single day.
There's another point here. Look, I've been a reporter for 30 years, and in many of the books, I went against the punditocracy. Hey, you pay a price for that. You know, they're in the feed of this ecosystem, and they will say, no, I don't have any reporting, but I know my punditry is undermined by your reporting, and you've got to be a strong reporter to do that, and there are not many out there.
Catch your breath. Ron, Randy, Nathan, Mary Beard is the queen of British historians on television and in hardcover. She gave us a marvelous conversation last January from her latest account of ancient Rome. She left us some unforgettable cautions about empires getting ripe and overripe, about the narrowing power bases of dynasties and families, the corruptions of money, and especially of language. We caught her this week on her way to a speech in New Haven, Connecticut, to ask what she is hearing on her American visit that sounds familiar.
In some ways, what's happening is that there is a crisis of confidence, not just in political leadership. I think there's a crisis of confidence in actually what political leadership amounts to. I think you see it manifesting itself really in the corruption of language in which we talk about politics, what we call post-truth politics. I think that those are symptoms of something bigger, which is really about, what is political leadership and power all about? What is politics for? In some ways, I think that's a very good and very interesting and proper question to be asking.
Mary Beard, Rome set these high standards of virtue, virtus, and citizenship itself. And it maintained a kind of critical eye on itself, even in its bad times. What's the lesson there and for us?
I think we've got to keep on thinking. You know, I mean, one of the things, I've been sitting, you know, in my hotel room this morning because I just got to New Haven and I'm about to lecture, and I got up early and I just overdosed on television, you know. And what I think is very depressing is the rather low level of interesting comment that I found on looking at the election result. There's plenty of comment. It's just not very astute. I mean, I think that certainly what Rome managed to continue doing, it had a real capacity to interrogate itself. I mean, I think that Tacitus, 2nd century AD historian, is a very good example of that, because he's thinking very much about empire and the consequences of empire and where you find virtue. And in some ways, his conclusion is that what empire has done in Rome is unseated virtus in the center of Roman power. And if you want to see virtus, he's saying, you have to go to the people we call the barbarians, because that's where Roman virtue is now to be found. Now, it's kind of those sorts of really imaginative and hard-hitting bits of analysis that I think it is lost from what I've been looking at on telly this morning, which is rather low-level reaction to what's going on, a combination of you know, slightly jingoistic self-satisfaction to rather self-righteous breastbeating.
Glad you mentioned Tacitus. We remember him mainly, and he's quoted from Vietnam to ISIS for that famous line, "We created a desert, a wasteland, and called it peace." Where else would he be poking us and say, look around you, look what you're doing?
I think in terms of language, actually. I think he would have been slightly horrified by some of the abuses of language that he's seen in the last couple of days. When I hear Trump say, you know, we've got to bind the wounds in our culture. And I think, but yesterday, you were opening those wounds. You were putting the knife in yesterday. Now, there is something which I find uncomfortable about the speed of the change of rhetoric. It makes me feel the language doesn't mean very much. Something has gone wrong with how we talk politics. I think that's what Tacitus would be bothered by. Democracy can't function if people don't have information. When I think about the ancient world, and I think both the Greeks and the Romans on that, they were deeply worried about rhetoric used to pull the wool over people's eyes. We have somehow got used to that. Well, you know, exaggerations always happen, don't they? Well, no, this is, democracy is not just about voting. Democracy is about people having the knowledge on which to vote. We have reduced democracy to a ballot box, I think. But actually, we have to think about education and about leadership, about how debate is conducted, and all those things. You know, democracy is more than putting a piece of paper in a box. Democracy at any period, it's always a process. It's not a thing that you can say you've got or not. Democracy is a way of thinking, and it's a way of developing the idea of popular power. It's always on the move.
And Mary Beard, what about this hardening inequality in the land where all men and women and children are created equal?
Yeah, what can you say? It's extremely worrying. I don't think it's new. You know, I think we shouldn't be looking back to, you know, a time that somehow we did equality better. And I think this much the same is true in the US as it is in the UK, that actually inequality starts almost at birth. If you look at educational achievement, how kids learn to read or whatever, an equality agenda is always very easy to shelve, I think, because we can say, look, everybody is created equal. We can look at all the formal equalities that there are, but we need to be looking at actually people's life chances and putting some of our resources in that. And we should be trying to press forward harder. and that you certainly don't find any good model there in the ancient world, which is one place nobody would want to go to find equality in, and not even 5th century Athens.
Even Athens at its best, she was telling us, to us here in the Athens of America. Ron Suskind, I was moved last week when Stephen Colbert embraced you and basically credited you with inventing his role. You had reported the George Bush team and their scorn for what they called the reality-based community.
Yes.
He called it truthiness. Yes. And a star was born. Yeah. What about it?
Well, truthiness. It's Colbert is answering the Romans. He's answering Jefferson in a way. He's saying that they didn't have television back then. What we have is television. And what does that mean? Image constantly trumps word. We are ever looking to that face, that image, that hint and suggestion. Trump is a master of this medium. And the ability to interrogate ourselves, as she says so brilliantly, is diminished. And maybe there is sand in those gears because of the time in which we're living. And what we might get from this election is a moment where we interrogate ourselves. And if so, we will have a yield of value from this time of crisis.
Let's find ourselves at Tacitus. Nathan Robinson, how do we correct our language, our introspection, our seriousness? A little bit, please.
Yeah, so, I mean, if we want to talk about post-truth politics, we have to be in touch with reality ourselves. Donald Trump was often derided for saying, well, I don't pay attention to polls. Turned out that he had a better finger on certain aspects of reality than we did. We need to have credibility. We need to understand that in order to be trusted, in order to have your critiques be taken seriously when you decry the 10 lies a second Trump tells, you have to have credibility of your own. And so you have to, it has to be that, I mean, with Clinton, we were sort of frequently defending things that were kind of iffy. You can't be doing that. You have to have honesty and integrity yourself. You have to be willing to examine yourself, to question your own biases, and to do the project of educating yourself so you can educate others.
So how then does Trump become president, if that is true?
Well, hold it. We're going to get to that.
No, I'm interested in Nathan's position. How then does Trump become president?
How did Trump become president? Because he had a better finger on the way the real world was and the way people were in the real
and
world.
And nothing he says is truthful.
Right. And Professor, nothing he's, right.
Professor Randall Kennedy, lead us toward our Tacitus.
I think that the comments that have been made recently, I would embrace, I would add to it that the media needs to also educate us about some issues that weren't even discussed. So we had an election. Half the people who could have voted didn't vote. We never talk about that. I mean, half the people who could vote in our electorate is shamefully small. Why is it that half the people who could vote don't vote?
Interesting little point. The surge that we expected from non-voters for Trump didn't show up. But the voters, a lot of them didn't come out. Still to be figured out, whether that was suppression or boredom or...
We need to talk about just the basics. Why is it that you have to jump through so many hoops to vote? Why is it that we allow people to discourage voting? Why is it that working people are just clearly discouraged from voting? We have this, you know, if you're working during the day, it's very hard to get out to vote. Why is that? We also have, what about the issues that weren't discussed? So much time spent on the server, so much time spent on a whole bunch of things, basic issue of global warming.
Not a word about global warming. No,
people don't even talk about it.
Not a single word. Nathan, you're on fire about this digitization of the conversation. Numbers, data, without intuition, without humanity. There's some implication there about our fundamental education, starting in K-1 or before. What's to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, so the climate change thing is very important. I think those of us who take climate change, for example, seriously have to recognize that it's our job to convince people. This has to be, the entire realization to me is that we have to take the responsibility on ourselves to realize that if you don't convince people, they are susceptible to lies and that it's your job. And Hillary Clinton didn't bring up climate change nearly as much as she ought to have either. The climate scientists should be going on listening tours of the country to churches, to libraries, taking people's questions, helping them learn to help themselves, and being humble and realizing that education is something we do together.
Thank you all. Thank you, Ron Suskind, Randy Kennedy, Nathan Robinson, and Kathy Kramer in Wisconsin. Special thanks to Adam Schatz of the London Review. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.